Welcome to our podcast series, Talking with Traders, hosted by expert trader Garth McKenzie in London, from where he's interviewing various guests on the topic of trading.
My name is Garth McKenzie. I've been trading since the age of 16. I headed up the retail derivatives desk for a large stockbroking firm in South Africa from 2003 until 2009. After that, I left the corporate world and I started traderscorner.co.za, an online service that caters to DIY traders, providing analysis and trader education. I also ran the Traders Corner TV show on Business Day TV for over 10 years, from 2009 to 2019. I've recently relocated to the UK and I trade both the South African and the offshore markets. Through this series, we hope to connect traders with other traders across the globe to share information, tips, and general advice on derivatives trading. The podcast series is brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. On to today's episode. Joining me this afternoon is Brian Gibbs, a very successful trader, a guy that I've known for a number of years. He came on one of my trading courses down in Durban some years ago, and has a lot of experience in the market long before I met him, and has a great pedigree in the market. So Brian, thanks very much for your time, taking the afternoon to chat to me. I really do appreciate it. It's good to speak to you. I know you're down in South Africa at the moment, but we've recently been in touch with each other and in contact in the UK as well, the two of us. And we keep in regular contact in terms of markets and trading and what have you. So thank you very much for taking the time to chat to me today.
It's a pleasure, Garth. Anything to break up the monotony of the current lockdown.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all sitting at home doing our bit and waiting for this lockdown to end. So stay safe out there. Just let's get straight into it, Brian. When did you start trading? What got you interested in the market? And tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are.
Sure. My background is that I went to university and was trying to become a chartered accountant. And as soon as I got a VAC job working as a trainee auditor, I realized that it was not perhaps how I wanted to spend my life. And so it was simply a case of money, to be honest. And from what little I knew at age 17 or 18, I thought getting into the stock market would perhaps be the best way to make money as quickly as possible. And based on that, I actually left honors at WITS. And at the time, the finance and marketing department at WITS was running the stock exchange members exams. And I signed up for that, much to my father's dismay. And that was about 3 months of going to lectures in the evenings, Monday to Thursday. And I was exposed to people who actually physically worked on the stock exchange in Johannesburg and had been invited to become partners or stockbrokers. And that's when I met people. And based on passing those exams, I walked around the JSE with my CV until eventually I got a job. And then just progressed from there. I started off in the back office. I went and was fortunate enough to learn how to trade on the floor. And then later on, I went back to university and went to business school at UCT, went back to the same broking firm and co-managed what we'd probably call a hedge fund. It was basically the prop desk. At the time, the company had listed and had a fair amount of capital that needed to be deployed. And yeah, spent a couple of years in the market as a sales trader. And about 10 years ago, decided that it was time to branch out on my own, and been trading for myself professionally and managing a bit of external cash for about the last 10 or 11 years.
That's very interesting background. So you say that you were on the floor. What year did you start in the markets then? Because the floor, I remember, closed, I think, in 1996. So you obviously were around
Some time before. Yeah. That. It was probably 94, maybe late 93. So a good 18 months of learning how to trade in the open outcry system. And very fortunate when I look back, was exposed to some very astute people who taught me all about money and trading, and gave me a lot of confidence, and perhaps taught me that making money and learning how to trade had very little to do with academic qualifications and what was written in a textbook. And I look back fondly on those years, and certainly I can say those 18 months to 2 years, I learned as much as I did at any university.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I can certainly agree in terms of the academics not necessarily being correlated with success in the markets. I mean, I've come across some very, very bright people who have been clients of mine over the years, and not all of them are very good traders. And I've come across some people who would, let's just call them street smart, and they make excellent traders. So it's certainly not a direct correlation between the level of academia and success as a trader. That's, and I can certainly agree with that.
Yeah, definitely my experience as well. And I can think of many examples that fit what you're saying. And perhaps speaking from my own experience, having textbook answers and knowing how markets should behave, and because you've got a background in, say, finance or in accounting, and you've analyzed a company, one of the biggest problems I find is that it tends to create this willingness or want or need to control the market and the outcomes, and that's certainly probably the biggest obstacle to success in the markets.
Yeah, absolutely. And agree with that. When it comes to your story as a PA trader, trading your own capital, I mean, I presume you did a lot of trading of your own capital whilst you were at the firms that you started at in the beginning.
Yes.
What were your early years like when it came to trading your own capital? Were you successful from the outset, or did you have a lot of stumbling blocks? Did you have to jump over many hurdles, as so many traders do in the early days?
I would say successful from the outset, and that was probably because I just had confidence and didn't think anything could go wrong. And having a background buying and selling shares on a constant basis, I was very familiar with the environment, and I can certainly think of lots of war stories that go along with that support it. But if I use this measure, if I say that I sold shares too early, then that moderates the result somewhat. And I would say that based on that, I definitely didn't make as much money as I possibly could have. And certainly when I look back on those years, I knew very little. And there was a distinct time where I made this separation. When I was trading other people's money, in other words, institutional or company cash, that was a very different mindset. Losses did not have an emotional impact on me. And then when I branched off later into managing money for friends, suddenly that changed a little, in that I was now very aware that if I was losing money, it would be capital that belonged to friends, and it didn't sit so well with me. And suddenly losses started taking on emotional meaning. And then when I extrapolated that and was trading money that was my own capital that had taken me years to build up, suddenly it was more pertinent that losses now were more meaningful. So I would say that I was successful from the outset, but not as successful as I could have been. And there was that sort of uncertainty lurking in the background, that the more I traded, especially my own money, the more it became problematic.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, I can also, you know, say from my own experience, I think you talk about you could have made more money in the beginning. And I suppose that goes to the point of saying it's probably the hardest thing in trading is to know the right time to sell. And I still find that in my own trading. You know, you either sell too early, which is often the case, or alternatively, you overstay your welcome and you don't sell early enough. So for me, that's actually the hardest part of trading. And the other thing you talk about is the emotional connection to the money when it's friends' money and versus when it's your own money versus an institution's yes. money, which doesn't really have a name or a face, or you have no emotional connection to that money. Now, I can corroborate that as well. I've also looked after friends' money in the past, and I don't do it anymore. And to be very honest, I never want to do it again, because the pressure of looking after other people's money, is particularly people that are close to you, friends or family, is immense. I can look myself in the eye and take a loss on my own capital, and that's hard enough. But knowing that it's your friends or your family's hard-earned money is very, very hard. So on that basis, do you still look after some friends and family money, or did you decide to give it up as well?
Well, the changes in compliance have made it more difficult. So I went through a phase where I gave it all back, but I'm now in the process of getting back into it. And I think the rule for me is, number one, make it clear to friends or people that you know, in fact, anyone who's prepared to give you money to manage, that there is a chance that there will be losses, and that somewhat mitigates the emotional impact. But I think that the overall solution is, you've just got to learn how to manage the emotions and not think of trades as being right or wrong or as making profits or losses. They are simply exposures to the market that either work or don't. And if they don't work, it's probably no fault of anyone other than a simple fact that setups don't always work, and rather try and handle it from that point of view than trying to make the other distinctions.
Yeah. In the conversations with you, Brian, I've always found your understanding and the way that you view the market fascinating. I mean, we recently met at a Nero Cafe in London and had a lovely discussion one morning here. That was a couple of months ago. And I remember very distinctly yes. one thing you said is that, you know, it's like having a date with the buyers. So let's say you're in the market, you're waiting for the buyers to show up. You've set a date with the buyers and they don't show up. And that stuck with me. I just thought that is such an interesting way of putting it. And you know, you don't take it personally. You just move on. You get up and you hope that the next time you have a date with the buyers, they show up again. And I really loved the way you put that and the way that you sort of articulated it. And maybe you can just elaborate a little bit more about that sort of line of thinking, and also just maybe tie that in with the type of strategy that you follow with your own trading and what your primary trading strategy
sure.
is.
Yeah. Well, firstly, I can't claim that was my own thinking. It belongs in that book that we spoke about, and I can't remember the guy's name now. Is it Mark somebody?
Mark Douglas.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah,
so I have to give him, that's right, and I give him all the credit for that, and it certainly resonated with me. At the time, I was going through a phase where I wouldn't put trades on very easily. I was trading futures and trading them on a very short-term time frame, and was focusing on losses and finding it very difficult to pull the trigger and get into trades. And so I was doing a lot of reading at the time, and I found that to be the most helpful book with respect to trading. And it basically says that 90% of trading is emotional, and the rest is capital management and your setups. And I would concur. I've learned that the hard way. And that's where that comes from. And the other thing that he says is, technical analysis is largely imaginary. And again, that resonated with me in that I've never found it easy to identify patterns in the market, and always wondered how one person could see an inverted head and shoulders and someone would see a triangle or whatever they're looking at. And, you know, he simply refers to them as imaginary lines on a screen. And all they do is they show the history of what buyers and sellers did in the past. And what buyers and sellers did in the past can obviously be mapped. And given human bias and the way people behave, patterns or technical analysis does provide some clue as to what happened at a particular level in the past. And that is usually a high probability area to get involved. And I know a lot of people that I've spoken to, they will not put a trade on unless they see a very clear pattern, and they won't enter a trade unless they have a very clear idea that they're going to get a 3-to-1 or 2-to-1 reward to risk ratio. And I have just simply been unable to follow that. Instead, I simply say to myself, I have no idea what the market is going to do this time, except that in the past, this zone has been a zone where buyers have arrived, and I'm just going to make myself available here, get some long exposure in the market on the basis that they do arrive and take the prices higher. And if they don't arrive, that's no one's fault, least of all mine. And I have a very clear area where below which they clearly aren't going to arrive, and it's time to get out of the trade and take a small loss. Really as simple as that.
Yeah, I love the way you put that so succinctly, and the way it's kind of mechanical in your mind, and you don't take any emotion about it. You mentioned waiting for the buyers to turn up, and obviously that is always we use that term in the context of trading the market from a long perspective. Do you Yes. also trade the market from the short side as well, or do you find you're primarily a long-only type of trader?
No, definitely from the short side, and in fact, I'd probably be more inclined to go short. Much to my detriment over the years. And the background to that is when I started and when we were managing a fair amount of capital on a prop desk, we were long short traders. So we would buy Anglos and sell Billiton. And back in those days, there were a lot of holding company structures on the JSE. So for example, we'd buy Gencor and sell Standard Bank, Goldfields and Impala, playing those discounts, and would be quite comfortable going the other way, just very aware that at some point there could be an announcement that a holding company structure could be unbundled, and that would often count against you. So that's where the short side comes from. As I say, it's probably been to my detriment because it has given me two bad habits that I've had to work very hard to get over. And the first one is averaging in, because if you speak to any long short trader, they will be very inclined to tell you how charts mean revert, which is nonsense. They do happen to get back to the mean, but that's just coincidental. I think trends are as prominent on long short trades as they are in any stock. And the other one is fading a trend. So where you get a pullback, I used to be prolific at shorting that and trying to buy it again when it got back onto trend, let's say onto the 100-day moving average. But neither of those were very good strategies. So okay. Very comfortable being short, probably shorting, inclined to short too often though.
You're listening to Talking with Traders, a podcast series brought to you by IG, a world-leading online trading and investment provider. If you haven't checked out the IG online trading platform, please do so and visit IG.com. Also, make sure you subscribe to the podcast series on your favorite podcast app or website by clicking on the subscribe button, and you'll be notified weekly as we release new episodes. Okay, very, very interesting. Look, that's also my experience that I think anyone that shorts, you know, typically bears, perma bears, I find don't generally do well. Perma bulls tend to do better, but obviously it's important to be able to play it from both sides, which is what you've nicely articulated. Yes. There. One more quick question on risk. You know, you mentioned a moment ago that you don't necessarily, you know, have a specific level in mind where you're getting out or out of a trade. But when it comes to a risk, do you have a specific percentage of your capital that you're willing to lose on an individual trade when you go into an individual trade? And are you rigid Yes. about that?
Yes. So it would probably surprise people at how small it is. That's obviously what you read in any textbook. And what I do when people ask me about trading, I ask them to imagine having 100,000 Rand and they're given an opportunity in the market as to how much they would risk. And quite often I hear a number of, you know, they had put 50,000 into it, they had put 30,000 into it. You know, it's that sort of number. And when they ask me, or when I offer my size, they're very surprised that it's less than 10,000. It would be 2,000 or 3,000.
So that's 2 or 3% capital risk.
2%. For sure. And I do a lot of trading of futures at the moment. I haven't traded for the last 6 weeks, incidentally. But the number of futures that I trade is actually very low. And so it works out to it's less than 0.5% of my capital. And it actually makes very little impact. And it certainly frees my mind up in terms of if the trade doesn't work, I don't feel the loss painfully. You know, happy to take a 3,000 to 5,000 rand loss. But when it does work, it certainly makes it worthwhile having been in the market that day.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that's something I always say to delegates on my trading courses. I say that, you know, if you're losing 1% or 2% of your capital on a trade, the nice thing is that after that, you've still got 99% or 98% of your capital left, which is a substantial chunk. And you're not likely to lose any sleep over losing 1% or 2% of your capital. And your emotional strength is still there, that you'll be able to come back and fight another day tomorrow and have another go at the market. Whereas when you've lost, you know, 20, 30, 40% of your account, as unfortunately many, many people will have done during this recent market crash, well, then coming back from that is hell of a difficult.
Yes. Aside from the emotional sides of things and dealing with emotional losses that can take you out the game, I also think that it's also based statistically that if you are prepared to lose smaller amounts, by definition, you are able to take a larger number of trades as opposed to two or three trades where you're risking a third of your capital. And yeah, I wanted to stress that probably the best resource for that is the so-called Van Tharp sizing, which I came across. And there's nothing really new to it. I have read that in a number of textbooks, where simply if you have, you know, 100,000 rand to risk, let's say, and you or your total capital is 100,000, and you're going to accept a loss of, let's say, 2,000 per trade. If you buy at 100 and you know where your stop is going to be at the market, and you take that difference, you're able to work out how many contracts or how many shares that you're going to buy. And it's that simple. It's that simple and that mechanical. And again, it wasn't my idea. I've taken it directly from a textbook.
Yeah. You mentioned Van Tharp, and I know in our discussions, you've also mentioned somewhere else, and I just can't recall for the life of me now. Maybe you can just remind me that there's an online exercise that you've done in the past where you go on, and it's basically like a simulator that you can practice your trading, practice your position sizing. Just tell me a little bit about that again, because I think that'll be really interesting for the people listening to this podcast.
Yes, it is from his website. So if you go to his website, which I think is vantharp.com. And if you look at his free resources, somewhere there's what he calls a trading game. And your goal is to take a certain amount of capital. I think it's $10,000. And your target is to make 14,000 or 15,000. And you have 75 trades in which to do it. And you have to figure out, using his sizing, the one that I just described, how many shares that you're going to buy and where you're going to put your stop. And once you've figured that out, you enter it into the model and press go, and it just gives you a random outcome. And you are either going to make what he calls the money at risk. He gives it the annotation R. You're either going to lose R, or you're going to lose 2R, or you're going to lose 10R, or you're going to make 2R or 1R, and so on. And I found it a very useful game to simply show myself, or remind myself and people who want to get into trading. That's all it is. It is a function of controlling how much you are willing to lose, and a function of how many trades you're going to make, because you cannot control the outcome. You can have a very good idea of what the outcome is going to be, especially if you're trading with the trend, but it is that simple. So simple, in fact, people struggle to get it.
Yeah, that's right. Trading is not actually that complicated. I think it's just us that make it more complicated for ourselves very often. Yes. Brian, we're heading towards the end of the interview, lots of time. So I just want to ask you three more questions. First of all, In your mind, do you have a best trade in your career that immediately springs to mind? And also, do you have a worst trade that immediately springs to mind?
Yeah, the worst trade wasn't just my trade, but it was a trade that we took on the book, and some very clever people and some very clever analysts involved. And it was back in around about 2000, just before 2000, when there was a lot of unbundling, and it was the cross-holding between Animint and De Beers. And some very clever minds were applied to that trade, and that was going to be unbundled. It was a cross-holding, and it was going to be unbundled at a premium, and we were going to make a lot of money. And I won't go into numbers in case people are out there listening, but certainly the two lessons were that was an outsized trade in terms of the capital involved. We're talking hundreds of millions of rand. And it was outsized in terms of the loss that was suffered. We did actually trade it back into a profit, and it was fortuitous that when it did eventually, or the unbundling was announced, we were the right way. We had traded it back into a slight discount, so it unbundled at parity, and all the losses were made good. So it certainly felt like we made a lot of money. But in actual fact, we spent about 46 months sweating and wondering whether we were going to keep our jobs. And in fact, reaching a point where we just thought it was funny because there was no doubt in our minds we were all going to get fired. And so that was probably the worst trade. Maybe the best trade was the company I worked for when they listed. I simply asked for an increased allocation in the number of shares I was given and had to borrow and pay for. And it was in a lock-up period, so I wasn't able to sell them or touch them for 5 years. And so that probably turned out to the best trade. So the lessons in both of them, and lessons that you'd read in any textbook or hear from any trader that's been around the block.
Yeah, excellent. Now, speaking of lessons, this is the last question I've got time for today. But yes. If you were to give a young guy or girl some pointers in terms of what to do, if you know someone that's just starting to get into this business, let's just say for argument's sake, your son. I know you've got a son who's at varsity at the moment, and let's say he says to you, "Dad, I want to become a trader." What do you tell him if you give him sort of three very basic pointers? What are the three most important pointers you'd give to him?
Well, there'd probably be more than three. Firstly, I would encourage it, because probably the biggest principle that I've learned over the last couple of decades is that no one is going to take responsibility for your money as thoroughly as you are going to yourself. So I would encourage it, not necessarily to be a trader on an intraday basis, but certainly to understand how markets work and to have an idea of trend and where stops are and how much I would buy and sell. So the first thing I would do is encourage it. The second thing is I would try and find a mentor. If you can find a mentor, someone who's willing to let you sit there and watch and ask questions, that would be ideal. That's often pretty impossible. And when I look back, the only mentor I had was on the floor, where I was told, do this, do that. But it was more a case of, you know, how to get the best price than it was to, you know, from an investment point of view. So if you can't get a mentor, I would certainly make sure that I went on one or two courses where you would probably learn the mechanics of trading, not necessarily technical setups, but just the ideas behind it. What you got to do to stop losing all of your money. And the third and probably the most important thing I would say is focus on the emotional aspects of trading. If you've got those down, you can learn the technical things much quicker. As Mark Douglas says, I mean, the typical way a trader learns is they get access to the internet, they download a trading platform, they've got a bit of capital, they put on a trade and they have a string of successes and they wonder why they didn't start this years and years ago. And then they start making losses and they make the false assumption or the false analysis that there's something wrong with their methodology. And so they dive into better technicals and they start adding momentum indicators and all these things to their charts. And pretty soon their charts are illegible and they just get into that hole of paralysis by overanalysis, whereas in fact they are probably just experiencing the emotions of losing for the first time and don't know how to handle that. So those are the three that I would concentrate on.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Those are brilliant. Well, Brian, thank you so much. We've come to the end of our allotted time, but I really, really do appreciate you taking the time to talk to me this afternoon from Durban. And I know that you'll be heading back over to the UK at some stage in the not too distant future. So I look forward to catching up with you again over here over a beer or two at some stage soon. But yeah, once again, thanks so much for your time. I really do appreciate it. And I think that the listeners to this podcast are very, very fortunate to have had 30 minutes with you and the years of experience that you've imparted here. So thanks again.
Yeah, my pleasure. And if anyone's got a question, they can direct it to you. I'd be more than happy to give them my answer, what I think I would do.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Brian.
Okay, Garth.
Right. Cheers. Thanks for joining us for today's episode of Talking with Traders, brought to you by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a leader in the field of online trading involved in this series. Please follow us on Facebook and engage with us there. And a reminder to make sure you subscribe to the series by clicking the subscribe button on your favorite app. Till next time.